members of the House, I declare this the 19th ordinary meeting of the 175th session duly constituted and call upon the Secretary to read the minutes from the last meeting.
Hi boys and girls, it's me. On the 7th of March 2024, it says 2023 in the sheet, the Queen's University Belfast Literary and Scientific Society convened for the 18th ordinary meeting of the 175th session for the, as the sheet says, Dufferin competition. As usual, the meeting began with announcements. After the Secretary spoke, President Toff introduced everyone and explained the rules for the Dufferin. Dermot Hamill, HLM, raised the conversazione and begged people to go to it. Dermot demonstrated an understanding of at least two Italian words in what he said. Ella Griffiths said the word money. Everyone applauded. She has a money box. No applause. President Toff discussed literary... Oh, I'm not allowed to talk about that next bit because it mentions a certain thing. He then introduced our guest president, William Crawley, famous for not showing his face. William Crawley sauntered up to the stage. Channeling Joe Biden, he stated, quote, "I don't know why I'm here." He then expressed his concern at the minutes that had been just read and remarked on, quote, "Dermot's dark clothing and threatening aura," end quote. He mentioned his career, I lost track, and then he discussed the importance of verbal fluency, not realising this is literific, not Ulster University's debating society. Literific helps to develop the ability to analyse remarks, not true, and call out rhetoric, not true. Lord Dufferin understood this. Lord Dufferin is now dead. He's not as well known here as he is in Canada. When the literary came into existence, they knew of his importance. He's dead now. He talked about how intelligent we all are. Look around. He then announced the motion, quote, "This House believes it is time to negotiate with Russia." Then the vermin scurried out. Following a reading of the minutes, which actually happened to occur before that, the meeting moved on to private members' business. Adam Mandeville raised the issue of France. Responses were heard from Max Kieran, Luke Anthony Patrick Maguire, and Tom Burns. Noah Barnley talked and raised the issues on Super Tuesday. Responses were heard from Ryan Hoey, HLM, me, and regretfully Noah Barnley. Keir Robinson raised Thomas Hobbes. Luke Maguire spoke, quote, "Speaking as a bad person," end quote. Sam Hazlitt was here and raised the issue of British telecoms, not BT, British telecoms is the correct way he would say it, and then raised the fact the phone books were discontinued. Responses were heard from Adam Mandeville, myself, Max Kieran, regretfully, Jacqueline Bonner, regretfully, Anna Mandeville, and Keir Robertson. President's questions, thankfully, did not take place. After President's questions, the vote in prior opinion was then held. There were two votes for aye, 13 for nay, and 12 abstentions. By a West Belfast margin, the opposition had it. First in the proposition was Dermot Hamill, HLM, looking a bit like a fox caught in the middle of the street, because he wasn't in his usual position in the last place. He thanked William Crawley for chairing the debate on tuition fees, which nobody listened to. He then set out two important issues, post-war Ukraine and the cost of the war. Quote, "Why be logical?" end quote. He began by quoting Daniel O'Connell. "The route forward for Ukraine is for peace, and we must condemn war." Very, very important words here. He's saying, "The amount of people dead is, quote, 5 Nuries, end quote, if one calls it humanity." Not my words. He mentioned refugees being displaced and that Ukraine will be a shining example of a post-war that superpowers cannot run roughshod, his words, not mine, over small nations. Neither nation is going to win this war and we must side with democracy and freedom, and that's why he's supporting Russia in this debate. First in the opposition was Cormac McSparran. Quote, "Thank you for starting with Daniel O'Connell. I'm going to start with somebody on the same level, Bertie Ahern," end quote. Dermot wants to live in a world where Vladimir Putin is undisputed power. Putin makes us question mutually assured destruction. Khrushchev was mentioned. This is not an imperial war, but rather one about power and influence, East versus West. Quote, "If Putin is listening, please don't come after me," end quote. "We have pushed Russia towards madness and ruin. The war is leading to the questioning of the regime in Russia. Then there was discussion about killing people in Uri again." We're very normal people here. Second in the proposition was Jack Steele, looking extremely dapper as usual. He welcomed everyone besides me. Change was then was needed from within, he argues, and it does not happen proactively. In the 1990s, mediation was a tool for peace. And then he discussed Russia being isolated and othered and producing the way towards tyranny. War is a physical and emotional toll on people. blah, 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 displacement. And then he discussed the Sermon on the Mount as an argument for why you should help Putin. Second in the opposition was Orrin Graham. Hello, Orrin. He called the proposition Kremlin shills. Dermot has a stamp from Kremlin on his wrist, after all. The proposition wants Russia to win and to see people in Ukraine die. They want people to die. They will die. American tax dollars means nothing. We must detest Russia giving in. We must not negotiate with a madman and a murderer. Quote, we as the West must fight against men, end quote. What is this, Gamersgate or? Jack Steele was too heavy for him. The proposition wants to see Ukraine lose and human rights destroyed. Hear, hear. Third in the proposition was Ben Wilson. We must make Russia less anti-Western, and keeping them at war will not achieve this, he argued. Pragmatism and moral costs need to be factored in. He talked about, we walked around and pointed to people talking quite angry about artillery. Ukraine cannot keep up with the rate of Russian firepower. Russians are being backed into a corner, being backed by Indians and Chinese people. Russia is outgunning the Ukrainians. Russia strategically and doctrinally are in a good place. Quote, I must continue the fight, end quote. Ukraine is struggling even with Western support. And then he just screamed the word bleak picture at one point. Russia must not win. Third in the opposition was Ella Griffiths. At this point, the debate decided to pile off the side of the cliff. Blood makes her feel queasy. Let's focus on certain aspects. What about nationality, identity, and the country? Bloodshed has to be talked about much. On the subject of bloodshed, she talked about her time in school. Quote, I want to talk about primary school. I was bullied. Shock horror, end quote. She refused to name her bully and is still scared of them. However, I've written here, is still scared of me, end quote. Quote, she stole my cucumber, end quote. What was that about? Come on. We're still letting the big guys win. She became very insufferable and talked about economic costs. And then she talked about, quote, what will they tell her ancestors to come? Sam chuckled at this. The final speaker for the proposition was Luke Duffy. He began by insulting the society and thanking me. Quote, very Trumpian, said William Crawley. Western apathy is an increasing problem. Support is drying up, a lot of funding is going away. What happens when the West stops getting interested, end quote? We need to take into account isolationist perspectives. Ukraine's image is becoming impacted over time. What about military aid? What about the Minsk agreement? At this point, money was faxed to him from the Kremlin. The final speaker of the opposition was Tosh McSpire. Quote, this will be the last debate of the night, end quote. William Crawley began to mutter at this point. It's impossible to appease, Tosh said. Quote, bully someone on the playground. She talked about trauma stories, in particular her story of her sister Finvola, who is 18 and is being bullied by 12-year-olds in the school bus. Tulsa laughed at the thought of her sister getting hurt. Then she advocated assaulting children. There was a lot of discussion about burning bodies, and I'm really not sure where we're going, and quote, we did not give in to Hitler as he was doing overwhelming bad, end quote. What was the context of that quote? She discussed elections in Russia, which are easy and simple. 83% of Ukraine is still Ukrainian, and we can still win. Quote, Russia is bad because politicians are mysterious and they are shot by planes from the sky and can't run for election now, end quote. I've lost the room half a night. Debate over whether talks could happen. Quote, with Hitler in World War II, yes, there was bloodshed, but I don't know what happened to the rest of that comment, but it was quite strange. And there was a lot of discussion about school bullies. William Crawley then stood up and decided to sum up. Quote, standards have somewhat improved, end quote. On Dermot, he said, quote, how much blood is enough? Dermot will prevent him from sleeping, he said. However, Dermot did not discuss NATO. And then he stated, quote, Dermot did a sleepy drive-by shooting with Nuri mentioned. Not sure what that was in reference to. I don't really care anymore. Cormac then gave a good speech and the word moist was used here and there was a lot of applause. Jack offered to give a pocket square, the most sexual thing Jack has ever done in his life. The question was, is Jack a pacifist? Nobody was quite sure. Jack argued that Jesus was for appeasement. Quote, there was a lot of Bible from Pastor Steele tonight, end quote. Orrin, Kremlin comment was great. Then he said that we should ban laptops. He really liked Orrin's comments and talk taking POIs. Ben Wilson spoke well and was powerful with his responses, and he pranced about like this. That was commented on by William Crawley. His prancing about was good. Ella Griffiths, quote, high, buoyant, fun, energetic. Is this true? Anyways, Ella was pushed in front of a reversing bus. Ha ha, roadkill, end quote. Everybody laughed. One Crawley then fantasized about drilling Putin's head into the ground. Luke Duffy, quote, "Your hand was in your pocket, not sure what you were doing there," end quote. Keenan interventions then switched to Kremlin talking points. Tosh McSparren, quote, "I thought it was funny," end quote, he said, talking about her sister being bullied. Choices of appeasement versus fighting. Questions have been heard from Ryan Howie and Kira Swale, who went on and on and on and on. Following the debate, the announcement was made as to who had won. I've actually not noted down who it was, so I'm going to have to scroll up again. I'm going to say here, in terms of the winner of the team, it was my IC, Ella Griffiths, and Tulsa McSparren, and I was with Ben Wilson. So that was the winners of the Dufferin. Do I take the minutes as read? Oh my God.
Thank you for that, I think. Welcome to the 19th ordinary meeting of the 170th session. For the motion, this House believes privacy is dead. We're a little thin on the ground tonight as there's various formals and meetings of the Democratic Unionist Party going on elsewhere in Northern Ireland, so we've lost a significant part of our membership this evening, but nevertheless, we will proceed anyway. Before we get into the order of business, we'll move to council announcements. So the first one is a matter of housekeeping, which is the Litterific is overseen by a board of trustees and has been ever since it's been refounded. The trust, chaired by Professor Tony Gallagher, has proven to be a significant resource for the society, both in terms of raising funds, connecting us with potential speakers and other guests, but also holding the council to account and making sure that the society progresses as it should. The trust that currently sits at 9 members, and we're looking to increase that slightly, and we're going to do so this evening, hopefully. We want to bring forward 3 potential appointments to the trust, based on their connection to the society. The first one is Calvin Black, who is a former president of the 169th session, a long-standing supporter and friend of the society, and someone who, when asked, is more than happy to contribute and help us out. He judged the Dufferin last week. He's given a lot of advice to the council. He did a hell of a lot as president, and was a really significant president, and we think that the trust would be the perfect appointment for him to continue to contribute to the society, and to keep going forward and helping us learn from previous sessions. The second is Ian Marshall. Ian was the first, or definitely one, unionist member of the Irish Shannon. And he is a long-standing friend of the society, having spoken at a number of debates. He now works at Queen's, so he's locally in the area, and he's been really supportive of us before. He's left an open invitation where we can call on him for kind of any assistance we think he need, and we think he'll be a perfect addition to the trust. And the third is Cara Hunter MLA. Now, Cara did a significant amount of work for us at the HIS debate. She was the MLA who sponsored our use of the Senate chamber, and she seemed to know a lot about the society. She seemed to be keen to contribute more after the HIS debate, and she spoke to me at length about the society and what she already knew, but seemed genuinely enthusiastic. And it was her that proposed the idea of the Litterific and the HIST doing a similar event every year, rotating between Belfast and Dublin, and that's an idea that we will be putting in place. So the council have approved all 3 appointments, and as per the society's constitution, we now need to get a vote of the House in order to do so. But firstly, can I have someone to second all 3 of the appointments, please? Thank you. If you'd like to vote in favour of the approving the appointments, please raise your hand now. Yes, we do. Yes, we do a vote. 19. If you'd like to vote against approving the trustees as laid out, please raise your hand now. And if you'd like to abstain on the vote, please raise your hand now. I think that is the three trustees unanimously approved. Thank you very much. Does anyone else have any council announcements? Tom?
This day next week, during the day, is our Dunderfield Schools competition. So we have schools from across the country coming up to debate during the whole day. And we will need people to judge and chaperone things with them. Just one to very heavily judge one of the children. Come and let me know after the debate if we can consult with the first.
Thank you. Do we have any more council announcements? Right.
Okay, considering an actual councillor is not here in Dermot, the social officer, considering I'm the person sponsoring the Conversazione. So, the deadline to purchase your tickets for our annual formal Conversazione held at the Ulster Reform Club on Monday the 25th of March is next Wednesday, because I'll need to get all the names and dietary requirements and everything over to the club. By then, I've been told. So if you've not purchased your ticket, please do. It's £35 for members and £40 for non-members, and it'll be a very good night with nice food and lots of wine, and there will be wine on arrival and wine on the table, and hopefully lots of good times by everyone. So yes, please purchase your tickets for the best formal at Queen's.
Thank you. Do we have any more council announcements? That seems to be them all. So we'll now move on to private members' business. This is the section of the evening where you can raise anything you've seen in the news this week or something you're interested in and wish to put before the House. Do we have any pieces of private members' business this evening, please? Ryan?
So, this is a bit of an interesting one. I don't usually follow or comment on or raise things that happen down south. But last week there were two referendums in the Republic which got overwhelmingly defeated by, I think, about two-thirds of some voters voted against the propositions. And it was interesting because none of the major parties, or all of the major parties, supported a yes vote on both the referendums, and yet it was overwhelmingly defeated. I think the first one was around, the family referendum was around including other durable relationships alongside marriage as a thing that the state should support. And then the second one was around clarifying and taking out that it's the woman's place in the home, sort of along those lines. But the problem with that one, I think, was that it also removed the responsibility of the state lessen the wording of the responsibility of the state to provide care. So that caused a bit of a backlash among groups supporting those with disabilities. So what does the House think about this? Does it show that the Irish political establishment is completely out of touch with their own voters?
Q, do you have any comments to make on this?
It's quite simple that people just don't want to vote yes, because it feels like they're giving too much up at once. When it comes to two referendums at the same time.
Q, do we have any more on this? We'll go Tom first.
I think what it shows, or the government being out of touch with the government, hopefully, running a campaign, was like probably they sort of blackbustered the whole way through. No one really knew what they were voting on. No one actually understood what the two amendments were. It was kind of just framed as a sort of free for everyone, it's going to be great, but no one actually knew what that meant. So sort of a mad mix of sort of general apathy about constitutional referendums, which happens all the time in Ireland, plus a really, really badly run campaign, a really incompetent government, I think kind of all came together to form one of the biggest embarrassments in the history of the Irish political state.
Do you anything else on this, James?
I think from the interesting points where you're seeing now, increasingly a lot of being involved, TDs coming out and saying, well, actually, no, I actually voted no. I did campaign yes, but actually I voted no, which means I'm actually deciding this referendum. I think it's sort of the point where Fianna Fáil has realised that, you know, giving the middle finger to their electorate for the last 5 or 10 years is really a bad electoral decision to make at the end of the day. I think traditionally, with the referendum, that it was probably a bad decision having from the US campaign on TV arguing that bigamy and polygamy are are durable and just as valid as legally binding marriages. I think probably a fair amount of the electorate might have turned off by that. They've obviously had dinosaurs.
From anything else on this?
Just the points that James has raised. I think firstly, in terms of the breakdown on the exit poll of the parties, I think the only main party whose voters actually did narrowly vote yes were Fine Gael voters. So they're, I guess, in an all-right position, only half of their voters disagreed with the position they took. Interestingly enough, lots of the major parties after the referendums took place started to say that, well, actually, it was because the voters, you know, we're just doing a protest vote against the government and didn't really know what the vote was on, which I think is a bit insulting to the electorate. The electorate isn't actually voting on what's been put in front of them. But, funnily enough as well, Sinn Féin, who also backed to Yes Yes, 80% of their voters voted no no. 4 out of 5 of their voters disagreed with what Sinn Féin was supporting. So I think it was a bit of a strategic mistake, which shows it's not only the government parties that kind of messed up on this one.
Do we have any more pieces of private members' business, please? Mr. Burns?
Go back to our rank, boys, more comfortable. The Tory Party has done another sort of racism, sexism scandal again. With their, one of their largest donors, I think, perhaps their biggest donor, I think, has given something like 10 or 15 million to the Tory Party in recent years, saying some pretty horrific things about Diane Abbott and the pension of to come under scrutiny for not wanting to give the money back and for obfuscating on sort of the seriousness of what the issue was. The speaker's also come under an awful lot of fire after PMQs yesterday didn't call on Diane Abbott to speak for herself on this topic. So what do we think about the Tory Party's new scandal? Whether she give back the money and what the speaker should do, what should happen with the speaker themselves.
Anything on this, please?
I guess what's interesting about this is that I guess the reason that the government doesn't want, or not the government, but the Conservative Party doesn't want to give back the money is it turned out that when this news story broke, it was thought that £10 million had been given by this person, whose name I can't remember, to the party. And then it's subsequently come out that an extra £5 million the Conservative Party has in the bank from this person. And given that the electoral cap on spending in an election is around 34 million. That means that about half of the money that the Conservative Party has to spend on the upcoming election would come from this one person. So I can kind of see, regardless of the morality of it, that the why the Conservative Party doesn't want to give the money back. And then on the point about the Speaker, I think it was silly of him not to call on Diane Abbott, considering everyone else in the room was talking about her and the threats that, well, not a threat, but you know, the comments that have been made against her, and yet he didn't see fit to call her in PMQs.
Anything else on this? Go for it.
I think they're not going to even think about giving the money back because they know for a fact they're not going to win the next election regardless. So why bother? Why bother trying to appeal to the public?
Hugh, anything else on this or any further piece of private members' business? Luke? The way you laugh before speaking is just, oh my.
Let's cast our minds back to last week. An Easter tragedy took place on a Good Friday. My hat in Labrador in the wee small hours of Friday when we went missing. I was struck with grief. Like Mary below the cross, Christ. And then, on the third day, at 1:04 in the morning, I received news of the resurrection of this dear hat. This hat. That is not been in my possession until a couple minutes ago. Is damp, covered in lint, oddly wrinkly, covered to the balls, just really, really, really cold. But yes, it's the Easter miracle. This is the reason we do Lent. This represents Christ, I think.
Given that there was a big kind of conspiracy about what had happened to this hat. I think you should clarify for the House exactly what happened with this hat and where the hat ended up.
Okay.
Do you really want to know the answer?
The hat, I am told, left Lavery's in the side pocket of one Jacqueline Bonner. So God knows what that poor fucker saw the past week.
That's a bottle of pot. thank you. Do we have anything on the hat or any further piece of private members' business? If not, we will unfortunately move on to President's questions, which will keep as brief as possible. God help me. Does anyone have any President's questions today? Tasha?
Wasn't there somewhere else that you could have been going to today? You might have like skipped the literific for something else. Could you just like tell the House what that something else was?
No. So there was two options. I had three options ahead of me. There was number one, come to the literific and not have to hand the debate to James or Ella to chair. There was number two, I could have returned home, which I probably should have done. And number three was I had an invitation from my flatmates to spend the day in Dublin and then attend a certain concert that is going on in Dublin this evening, that, you know, would be embarrassing for me to reveal who the artist was. Jason Derulo, but so my flatmates are now currently sending me pictures of them at Jason Derulo saying, do you wish you were here? And I'm just like, no, not all. Luckily, I managed to sell my ticket, so thank God for that. So I'm here at the better event that is happening on the Island of Ireland tonight. Wow. Do we have any more President's questions?
Mr. President, what was the first thing you ate today?
A slab of milky bar chocolate. Yeah, that's quite nice. Anything else before we move on? Ella?
If you were going to miss the literature for one concert, not Jason Rubin, what would it be?
Coldplay. Anything else?
What would you wear the hat?
No. Absolutely not. Anything else before we move on to vote of prior opinion?
Yes.
Oh, God.
What's your favourite Jason Derulo song?
Now we'll move on to the vote of prior opinion, which is the part where you vote on the motion before you've heard any of the speeches tonight. Just to remind you, the exact wording of the motion is, this House believes privacy is dead. If you'd like to vote in favour of the motion, please raise your hand now.
Wait, Abby.
Yeah. If you'd like to vote against the motion, please raise your hand now. Kira, you've already voted.
No, I haven't.
Three, four, five. And if you'd like to abstain on the motion, please raise your hand now. One, two, three. Can we get the vote of prior opinion, please?
On the question at hand, there were 17 votes for aye. I genuinely can't believe that there are that many people in the room here. 6 votes for nay and 3 abstentions, so by about nearing our man margin, the proposition has won it.
Thank you very much. Now, before we welcome the first speaker, I'm going to run through the rules for the evening. A full list of rules through our standing orders is available on our website, but here is an overview. Each speech is 7 minutes long, with the first and last minute being protected time. The end of the first minute of protected time, the start of the final minute of the speech will be signalled by the bell, which means you can only offer points of information in the middle 5 minutes. To offer a POI, raise your hand and say point of information on that point or simply POI. Please keep your POIs to 10 seconds long, and if they go over 10 seconds, you'll be cut off. And no barracking, meaning wait at least 15 seconds after either you or someone else has given a POI to give another one. Once you've made your POI, you cannot go back and forth with the speaker. If you need to leave the room at any time, do so quietly between speeches. Ryan, do not leave or re-enter the room whilst the speaker is speaking. Remember that any noise from outside does travel, so please shut the door and keep the noise down. Lastly, no swearing. If a speaker swears, they'll be fined a bottle of port to be presented at the next honorary meeting. Firstly, we will... Right, that seems to be everything. Can I welcome Evie to open the case for the proposition?
Hey guys, I am Oren Green. No, I'm Tasha McSparrow. Okay, there we are, we're back. This podium is still, yeah, I'm not touching that. Right, well, ladies, gentlemen, both, neither, in between, Luke Anthony Patrick McGuire, for the minutes, by the way. 54.55-42-57, comma, -5.98-1912. That, my dear friends, is the home address of one of the magical mystery speakers on the opposition tonight. Good luck with that in the minutes. So, privacy, what is it? Is it that thing that Mr. James Orchard thought he had whenever he made those comments on the 15th of November 2018? I wasn't there, but I'm not going to repeat what you said. No, generally speaking, privacy is the right to be left alone, free from intrusion. And more specifically, it's freedom of control over your own information, how it's published, how it's gathered, and how it's disseminated. But also, it's about as dead as the horse which I'm going to be beating tonight. So I can stand here and make low blow after low blow, constantly go after the low-hanging fruit, for example, reading out another IP address or another longitude and latitude. That would be hilarious, but I'm not going to. No, instead, I'm going to go for a liver punch here. Did you know that there is actually no legal right to privacy in the UK? Yeah, no, seriously. That's right, I am here to talk legal shop once more, and tonight's topic just so happens to be the topic of last week's lecture, which, Christ on a stick, there is a God, because I forgot I was on this debate and did not have enough time to prepare. So that's quite fortunate. But yes, anyway, there is actually no legal right to privacy in the UK.
On that point.
Sure.
So then, does that mean that there is never the ability to create privacy again? You're saying it's dead and can never come back?
I'm saying that you actually have no legal protection to any form of privacy, so whenever we're talking about the principle of privacy, yeah, you actually have no way to defend that. Anyway, English and Welsh law lacks the tort of privacy. In US law and most other common law jurisdictions, people with normal, sensible, thinking heads, they have the principle of intrusion into seclusion and disclosure of embarrassing private secrets. These are two different things which are encompassed in the same principle, but only the latter is recognized in the English and Welsh common law. This is known as the misuse of private information, blah, blah, blah. This emerged from a common law principle of breach of confidence, post-Human Rights Act, we love 1998, and seminal cases. Now that we're all thoroughly bored, what do I actually mean? Well, in the UK, I only legally invade your privacy if I, quote-unquote, misuse your information. But the actual gathering of this information, collecting it, keeping it for myself, that is completely A-OK. For example, Kay versus Robinson, 1991, a celebrity who was given a traumatic brain injury, the news outlet went to their hospital room, took photos of this very vulnerable, barely conscious celebrity, quote-unquote, allegedly asked them for an interview, obviously because of the recovery process and actual brain injury. They don't remember consenting, if they ever did, in the first place. So they sued for... Yeah, sure.
GDPR. As per GDPR, I am not legally, as a company, allowed to contain information that I do not need. Hence, yeah, you have a legal right to privacy, GDPR.
That's statutory provisions in one specific aspect of society, but we're talking about everybody in this everybody in this chamber here. And also statutory provisions are failing, which I'll get to soon enough. They sued for malicious falsehood, defamation, passing off, and trespass to the person. All their claims failed, aside from malicious falsehood, because once again, there is no specific tort for privacy. Privacy law in the UK, for all I can say in 7 minutes, is not there to protect you. So let's go back in time. There's this thing in the UK called breach of confidence. Very simple equitable principle. Basically, I tell you a secret, you go ahead and tell that to the press, even though I told you not to, you breach my confidence, okay? What if we make it a little bit more complex? For example, if the media publish pictures of me walking out of an alcohol anonymous group or perhaps a drug rehab center without my consent, before 2014, there was literally nothing you could do. After 2014, there's still practically nothing you can do. So here's some more history. Three bills were proposed during the 60s to try to rectify this, basically tried to create an actual common law, like what is our definition of privacy? How can the courts uphold this? And how can we protect this? Minecraft, Lyon, Walden, all three of them tried, all three of them got the same contradictory, nonsensical reasons. One of them encroached too much onto freedom of expression, one of them encroached too little onto freedom of expression. They were both the same bill. Questionable government report after other questionable government report. So the Calcutt Committee, Younger Committee, that one in 2012 that I forgot the name of, that David Cameron was part of, all of them considered international law and how we could graft bits into the UK law. All of them said that international law gives us no resources and we shouldn't use that. Here in the critical thinking literific, I would like us all to, I would like to think that we all know that that's, I actually cannot say that word, I don't have money for a bottle of port. So even as far back as 1932, Percy H. Winfield urged the courts to create a common law protection for privacy. And 60 years later, there was still nothing, leading to the case, which I just read out for you guys. But let's talk Europe. Article 8, let's go to foreign policy. You guys like Article 8, right? Freedom of privacy, protection of privacy under the European Convention of Human Rights. Well, the ECHR is a delicate balancing act in the foreign courts between privacy and freedom of information. You've got your Article 10 rights and your Article 8 rights. How can we enshrine one and protect one without encroaching on the other? But in the domestic courts, Article 10 always wins. Freedom of expression always wins. Section 12.4 of the Human Rights Act 1998 calls for, and I quote, this is terrible wording, judges to carefully consider whether or not giving relief to an invasion of privacy would unjustifiably impact freedom of expression. And while I am incredibly for unfettered freedom of expression, this terrible wording has been misused by the courts to consistently beat out privacy claims and claim Article 10 rights. Yes?
What would you suggest instead then to get that balance right?
To get that balance right, I would... So they actually get it right in Europe, but in the UK, we don't have that same level of protection. So in this society, we don't have the same level of protection for privacy. Obviously, there's still issues with the European Court of Human Rights, but they have a better balance of 8 and 10. I'm not saying that Europe is perfect. I'm just saying that it's a better comparison to what we have here. I'm incredibly pro unfettered freedom of expression. It's not really helping out here. So with precious little European law and only one seminal case in the last 20 years, the public celebrities and individuals are essentially left at the mercy of invasive media and tech giants. Even in the wake of Von Hanover in 2004, judges in the UK refused to enshrine a definition of privacy. Instead, what we get is the legal principle of what a reasonable person in privacy, which is essentially a judge workaround to actually having to tackle the issue, whereas an entirely subjective test based on the facts of the case and how much they like the news article being published. So here we are in 2024, after 100 years of legal history, and what do we have for it? We've got failing statutory protections, we have the foreign courts constantly being batted out of our domestic legislation, we have a parliament who refuses to legislate on the issues, courts who don't want to set precedent, even though that's their job, and they don't want to do it in this one specific area for some reason, and they refuse to give any actual reason why. So, I mean, you guys can vote with the opposition if you want tonight, if you feel like you have privacy, if you feel it's not too bad, and if you feel the courts are there for you, but 100 years of legal history would say different. It's pretty cut and dry. Thanks.
Thank you, Dean Keating, for welcome to Talsham McFarren to open the case for the opposition.
Good evening, members of the House. Before this debate, I asked the proposition what their points were, and they would not tell me. Except Oren, who, his privacy's dead. He offered to let me read a speech. The proposition would like you to believe that privacy is simply your IP address, your location on Snapchat, your phone number, and your email address. They think privacy is the clothes you buy or the content you consume. But we on the opposition say that privacy is so much more than this and it cannot be killed. If I had in front of me two books, one with your name, address, search history and other data tech companies, and one with your thoughts, feelings, an exact transcript of your deepest desires and regrets, or events so integral to you that anyone who read would view you differently, which would you rather have published to the world? The first book the tech companies already own, and we knowingly gave it to them. We consented to them having this information. The second only we have, that is our private individual selves. That is the information we can take to our graves, no amount of algorithm can get out of us. So basically, unless the proposition believe that big tech and the state are some sort of omnipotent mind-reading gods, then privacy can never die. I'll actually take it, yeah.
Facebook have used data obtained from their websites to predict people's sexuality when they were actually in the closet and advertised to them gay cruises when that
was... 10 seconds.
Yeah, I kind of get more into this later, but all it can really do is like look at your name, your age, where you're from, and things like that, and make a guess. There's probably a million other people who also saw that ad and just thought, that's not for me. And like they show it to so many people. There's a mad coincidence, but coincidences aren't just on the internet, they're everywhere in life. So I think algorithms can just make a guess and put you into a box. That doesn't mean that they're always right. So the opposition say that privacy will exist as long as our individual thoughts and feelings exist, that a lot of the so-called data out there is skewed, and lastly, that privacy is not dead, just a little bit eroded. The propositioned have likened our current lives to some sort of Orwellian dystopia where we're under constant surveillance and Big Brother is watching us. But I think that they fundamentally misunderstood, like, the idea of, like, George Orwell's novel. Even with all the institutions in 1984 that persecuted privacy as a whole, they still could not get inside the mind of the main character, where secretly he hated Big Brother and wanted to rebel against the system. Because the best that any... No, thank you. Because the best... might need to have read the book. Because the best that any surveillance or data collection algorithm can do is look at our data and make a guess, an inference, put us into a box which they think we might belong. But you can ransack someone's home, you can record all their conversations, and yet you will never know what is going on inside their head. No amount of data is ever going to crack the fundamental mystery that is the human mind. We're inconsistent, we're unpredictable, and we change our minds like that. If privacy is dead, then, like, why do we have detectives to solve murder cases? If privacy is dead, then why do governments have to literally torture information out of people? If privacy is dead, then why the hell are we still wondering where Kate Middleton is? Just, like, even think about yourselves for a second. Like, the government may know that I worked at, like, McDonald's on Boucher Road when I was 18 for a year, but they don't know all the times, like, I cried on shift and why, so do they really know anything about my experience working there? Having privacy is having thoughts, big or small, that we never say out loud, that we take to our graves, and the proposition cannot not say that they are dead. Secondly, privacy isn't dead because a lot of the information out there that data collectors collect is incorrect. The California gang database contains the names and details of over 150,000 suspected gang members. In 2016, it was ruled to be full of unsubstantiated and incorrect entries, mainly affecting Black and Latino residents. It was fueled by machine learning algorithms that had recorded the names of 42 babies under the age of one as being self-described gang members. One second. And I understand that this was 2016 and the algorithm has advanced since then, but to this day it is still influenced by the same human creators that take data, they look at your name, where you're from, your skin color, your age, and they put you in a box. The big tech companies really have no interest in reality. Most of their data is biased, warped, and fabricated. Because if I was to read all of your search history, I still wouldn't have any clue who you were as an individual, and I wouldn't even scratch the surface of your private self. Kieran.
Well, like, just because they may have been incorrect in one thing doesn't mean they don't have pretty much a lot of your private information, such as where you live, where you go to eat, where you shop, things that you have almost no
exactly.
Yeah, but I'm saying that, like, they may have that, but it doesn't really matter because it doesn't invade your privacy because they still have no clue who you are as an individual. They look in the collective and they can say collectively a lot of these people do this thing and they happen to be, you know, gay, or they happen to be gay gang members, but they get it wrong consistently. So a lot of the data out there, it is warped and it is skewed because they have the same human bias that the world does. And the last point I would like to make is around the idea of death, because apparently we're all at privacy's funeral and the proposition are giving some very lovely eulogies, but I'm here to tell you that privacy is knocking on that coffin and trying to get out. Privacy is not dead, it just kind of has a flu. I agree tech companies probably shouldn't be taking our data and recording what we are saying and that this is an invasion of our privacy, but that is just a really small piece of our privacy. To say that privacy is dead is to say that it is completely obliterated, never to return. All privacy needs is some medicine, and you're trying to bury it alive. Privacy is not dead because we still have time to create laws that stop big tech from harvesting our data. People campaign for privacy rights, and we have debates like this where we can all say, somebody think of the children in the future, and do something to protect our privacy even better. I think that humans are filled with common sense and ingenuity, and to give up and give in and say, ah, sure, like, privacy is dead already, we can't do anything about it, is actually just giving in to the wants of the big tech companies. Big tech may have spent billions trying to invade our privacy, but the opposition say that the human mind is not so simple, that their data is incorrect, and that privacy is nowhere near dead. It just has a bit of a flu. Thank you.
Hello, President, our lovely Secretary, members of the opposition who are always being watched, you especially, Talisha, and members of the prop, and hello to everyone and all the members of the House. Today I'm talking about how privacy is dead. I'm going to follow along Evie's definition of privacy. It's the freedom to control our own information. And I'm going to talk about how governments, companies, and the internet have killed that and buried it deep, deep, deep underground. I'll demonstrate this through how our information is never truly a secret and it's always accessible to others, how all of our While everything we've considered private for our entire lives can always be exposed and is just a facet and a cover-up made by companies. And finally, how all of our data is being used against us and we have no real say in how our privacy is secured. This death of our privacy is due to the fact our lives are entirely online these days. I mean, this debate is online, it's on Spotify, I'm pretty sure. You wanna, and then further, you wanna go to university, you have to have an email, you have to be able to access the internet, you have to be able to use UCAS. And the internet affects every aspect of our lives. It's a multifaceted world we live in for it. But even those who would try to hide from the internet, if Sam was here, I'd point him out, but he's unfortunately not. I think the rain is scaring away. Even he has Snapchat. Even he uses the internet. Now, to my first point, the government does know where you are. It always knows where you are, and so do companies. Now, you might be asking me, how do these corporations, how does the government know where I am? This is due to the fact our phones are always being located as long as they're charged, our devices are always available ready, and everyone and any company that like such as WhatsApp needs to find your location, they can find it easily. No, thank you. In the pre-internet era, because internet's what killed the radio star, sorry, I mean internet's what killed privacy, in the 1990s, pre-1990s, it was extremely difficult for governments and by extension corporations to find you. They couldn't just drop your IP address or your geolocation like some kid on an Xbox these days. If they wanted to, they had to get real life stalkers and stalk you around, funny enough. Nowadays, it's just some desk jockey who can do it all from the comfort of their home. Half the time, they let AI do it. They let algorithms do it. The matter of fact is, governments and organizations can track you scarily efficient. They follow you through the internet on your phones and other devices. And they let, and I don't know why on God's green earth, cookies, like Candy Crunch needs to know my location, but hey, Candy Crunch needs to know my location.
Oh, no.
No, thank you. As, I'm going to pronounce her name wrong, Shashna Zuboff, a professor at Harvard, I pronounced it wrong, a professor at Harvard stated that last year in the EU, people's locations were exposed 376 times daily. You get exposed, your location gets more exposed daily than you'll live in your lifetime. If that makes sense, sorry. So governments are always tracking you. You're never truly secure in where you are, and your privacy has always been invaded as they can find you. Now, some of you might be thinking, well, Oren, if privacy is dead, why didn't you share with the class and give us your credit card information? And to that I say, no, and I'm afraid you'll pity me, because I'm dead broke. Now, the opposition are saying here, gleefully stating, huzzah, he has proved my point. However, whilst you might think your credit card information is private information, it isn't. A bank clerk knows every detail of yours and mine. This can be seen whenever I got called up for suspicious activity on Valentine's Day, whenever two meals were bought at Villa Italia. Lord knows above, I was saved. Yes.
But does that bank clerk know your deepest thoughts and desires?
He did know my deepest thoughts and desire was to have someone that Valentine's Day. Unfortunately, I did not have anyone that Valentine's Day. Now this shows, whilst many of you, thank God, do not know my credit card information, someone out there, oh, Evie apparently does, many of you don't, someone out there does, and someone out there can access my credit card information, and always, sorry?
That way you're broke.
Yes. And can use it against me. So I have no privacy whenever we come, so this facade of privacy, that some things are private, some things exist outside of the public realm, isn't true. Now your data is with. Now I'm going to move on to another point: why privacy is dead and the internet killed it. Your data is with organizations and governments, and they've helped manufacture a facade. Now, I'm sorry, I'm reading my own hand here. Now, as I brought up earlier, I only know one person in the room who rarely uses the internet, Sam. However, he's not here with us tonight. But our overlords, such as Google, still consume his data. They find simple things first, like your language or languages you speak. They can find much more sinister. Well, they word it very sinisterly. They can find the people who matter to you most. Direct words from Google's privacy policy, and we can send to all of us. We can send to them, combing through our data, combing through ever searched, and constantly using it against us. As it takes us 15 seconds to go through settings and make sure cookies isn't on, but we don't. They do this. Yes.
You can choose to just not use the internet. You can choose to completely live off grid. Doesn't that mean this practice is dead?
That was my point. If you wanted to live in the modern world today, at the start, you have to have access to the internet. I don't know anyone in this room who doesn't use the internet. You have a Facebook page.
When was the last time you used it?
Messenger. Today.
Nice.
They collect all this data and they put it into the big data, in which all of our data is collected, everything is added to it, and it's literally just called the big data. They comb through all this information and they use it for or against us, it doesn't matter. I'm not here to argue on the ethical point on that. But all of our data is collected, and as Evie's point at the start was, freedom to control our own information is privacy. We don't control any of that information put out there. We don't control any of it, as the software is used against us. And Talisha was talking about how algorithms can't think of what they like. I do know Jack Steele's TikTok shows him sermons and and shows him Thatcher quotes every night, but hey, I think it does know a wee bit of what we like. This relentless data collection leaves no facet of our lives untouched, eroding our privacy with every piece of information. To end this, privacy is dead. Companies and governments have killed it, and we allowed it to die. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Arvin, and I welcome Hugh to continue the case for the opposition.
All right, it's my first time. Go subtle. So, JDs and Lanthimen, and those not defined therein, yeah? Privacy isn't dead. Privacy is still alive. However, now the choice for your privacy is in your hands, more than it ever has been before. Now, everyone so far has been very concerned about digital privacy, especially. But before you go panicking, running off to a cabin in the woods, and getting very obsessed with postage, instead, I want you to start thinking about your digital anonymity as just that, anonymity. And that is how you gain your privacy. See, everyone's afraid about being shackled by these corporations who are trying to profit off everything about you, but you can opt out of every single one of these. It is genuinely something that's built into every single software that you use online, offline, whatever you want. I mean, you can even just, you know, go offline. How can they get the data? It's all local. See, corporations will do pretty much anything to try to get money. That's no secret, it's late-stage capitalism. It's what's pretty much to be expected. But you are completely in control of what they get. As Richard Serra once said, if something is free, then you are the product. But as a product, you are the one in power. You can choose not to be sold. And that's...
On that point?
Sure.
Any street that you walk down in the UK, we are one of the most heavily surveyed in terms of CCTV in the world. You're talking about private companies, but the state is always watching, and you can't consent to that unless you just stay in your house and never leave.
Yeah, my section's on companies, not on the state. You can literally assert your privacy by asserting your anonymity online. It's very simple. At the dawn of the internet, anonymity was effectively a guarantee. There was maybe four emails. You'd go around calling yourself Superman. No one could attribute that to you. Now, we have lost that with every single website requiring an email now, which isn't great. But you can literally just click no. You can go through the source and literally just delete the bit of code that makes that pop-up even happen. You can reject...
At that point,
sure.
Do you really think the general population is going to know how to do that? So would you say the general population has access to that kind of privacy?
I have an extension on my browser that does it for me. So yeah. You just need to pay attention to where your data is being collected and where it is going. And you can easily switch it off from there. You can opt out of every single cookie that ever pops up on your browser. It's very simple. You just hit no. You don't use services that try to track your data anyway. So Facebook, as it's been previously brought up, I haven't used Facebook in 7 years. I use Instagram, and I am very careful about what I put on there. How can they know anything if I just don't put it on?
On that point?
Sure.
Facebook owns Instagram, they know all the data you put on Instagram.
Yeah, that's why I made the clarification of Instagram. I am very careful about what I put on it, therefore they don't get as much. Whereas Facebook, the app, Yeah, I don't use that. I haven't used it in 7 years. I use a VPN. I use Firefox. I use extensions to make sure that I do not get tracked. I do not get cookies. These things are purely optional. You can literally just switch off what is tracking you. You have privacy if you assert it.
On that point?
Sure.
Is your information anywhere then? Does that, if we look you up, can find anything about you?
You'll probably find a Facebook account that's been dead for 7 years. It might actually be difficult. Like, sure, yeah, I put in a lot of effort to make sure that I have my privacy online, but it is definitely possible. You can block these keyloggers and cookies. You can literally do it just by being a little bit more careful. Sure.
I just found your birthday.
On Facebook, which has been dead for seven...
Over the last few years, and the fact that you followed Dennis
Littlefire
on YouTube.
I did. That's news. whatever. But the point is, it's been a dead account for ages. They only get what you are willing to put in. Again, that is very old information, which genuinely shocks me. Yeah, birthday as well. But it is genuinely what you put out there. Like, if you comment on TikTok, YouTube, that is what they get. But if you just don't comment, you're fine. Also, complete. I could feel you Googling me. you might fear the data collection, you might fear it, but you can easily tick the boxes that just say, do not share my information. Or, if you use browsers such as Firefox, you can literally just store it locally, so that way companies can't get it. You can delete it from your own device. It's really not that difficult, you just need to be a little bit more careful. That's it, you need to assert your privacy. I mean, you're the one who chooses to use Google. It's famous for stealing people's information. If you're using Google and you're complaining about your privacy, that's on you. Just use DuckDuckGo, I mean, come on. and, you know, we've had AI being brought up as a reason to fear this, but again, you can just, you know, be a bit more careful about what you put out there. Just don't use AI because it is literally just an advanced spell check. It's really not difficult to just avoid it. You know, everything that you put out there is attributed to you. It's a digital footprint, but you can control what is part of that footprint. So yeah, just be smart about hiding your data, or my personal favorite method, which is create burner accounts which are completely worthless. You fill it with so much fake information that it means nothing to these corporations. Anyway, that's it.
Can we get another round of applause for a maiden speaker? We can now welcome Ella Griffiths to close the case for the proposition.
Other speakers have said they aren't going for the low-hanging fruit, but I got called into this last minute, so I very much am. That's how I'm prefacing this speech. But, you know, a debate on privacy. Why not start it with a personal anecdote, you know? it just seemed incredibly fitting. So the other night, I sat down at my computer and I wanted to watch Cars. Now, yeah, the Disney film Cars, okay, not Formula One, I'm not that cool. And my computer kept telling me something. And it was, so there's hot MILFs 3 miles away. And these hot MILFs want to come and they want to talk to me. This is a vile breach of privacy. And this alone makes me believe that privacy is dead, because how does the laptop know that the MILFs are 3 miles away? And that they want to come and speak to me? Does my computer know something about the ladies across the road that I don't know? Probably. How does my computer know that the hot MILFs are after me? Well, at least the ones 3 miles away.
On that point?
I'm not sure about the ones 30 miles away. No, thank you. I would not be questioned on my MILFs. If I were in medieval times, I don't know if I would have gotten notes from the local maidens telling me that they were down to get freaky with me. That being said, I'm also in the literific, so I don't think it was ever that likely. Writing this introduction, I did want to Google what the medieval way of saying getting freaky was, but ironically, I was on Queen's Wi-Fi, and I didn't want it to show that Ella Griffiths 4392572 had Googled what is the medieval way of saying DTF. And that is what privacy refers to, ladies and gentlemen, Luke and in between. As defined by Google, I was okay Googling this, it's a state in which one is not observed or disturbed by other people. And I'm being both disturbed by MILFs and observed by the people controlling the Queen's Wi-Fi. The point I was getting to talking about medieval times is to illustrate that privacy as we know it, not so long ago, maybe even 20, 30 years ago, is very different to the privacy we face today now. Talsha, you said privacy isn't dead because you can keep things private. I can do that to an extent. But, you know, as we're increasing the amount of people that live in a digitized nation, we're also increasing the amount of people that use digitized diary apps. And in 2017, Emma's Diary sold over 1 million users' data. Which was used by the Labour Party to profile new members. Now, this is something you think you're keeping private, but...
Okay.
No, thank you. But, you know, once again, betrayed by the companies. And also, sorry, men, this might be a bit gross, but period tracking apps, such as Flow, have also disclosed millions of people's health data to millions of user data worldwide to different organisations. And I think this is what the motion means when we're talking about privacy being dead. We're talking about the line that we used to think of as invasive has now become somewhat the norm. And you know, if you said 20, 30 years ago, if you asked if you could put a company's camera on your door that they controlled, would you have let them? I know this is still a choice, but it illustrates that that line is being blurred. We live in an age where MILF's locations are publicized. Companies harvest data from millions of social media profiles, and the difference between identifiable and private data is diminishing. What's next? Military bases being identified through Quizlet? Yes, quite literally. This might seem like something out of Spy Kids with those giant thumbs that we're doing. But in 2021, it was discovered by Bellingcat that searches for phrases like PIS, WS3, Vault on Google led to the websites like Quizlet and Chegg, which had flashcards including details of passwords, coordinates for military bases, and how many bit cameras each camera had. Yeah, don't get me wrong, that's pretty stupid. But it's something that you think is going to be private, and it's not. So this is what I'm arguing. I'm arguing that the privacy that you think you have is dead. We are being sold the illusion of privacy by the big tech companies. And even though these things have been taken off, they can still be found on websites like the Wayback Machine. Going back to the definition of privacy, it is where you are not observed by other people. And using a revision app, you don't expect that other people will be able to find your flashcards, especially when it's about military bases. Furthermore, we all know that woke is taking over. The woke Avengers! Jokes and having a laugh. This is the future the woke want. But what if the woke could do this by reading your private messages? In 2022, a British student was on his way to Menorca, but before departing Gatwick Airport, he messaged his friends on Snapchat, making a joke about blowing up the plane. The intention of this message was never to cause actual harm, and he didn't in fact intend to blow up the plane. But Mr. Verma got arrested for the messages. Snapchat is an encrypted app and supposedly private, so how did it happen? Well, it's believed by one of the judges that unknowingly to Mr. Verma, the messages had been picked up by security mechanisms of England when the plane was flying over French airspace. Going back to the definition of privacy once again, the state where one is not observed. If Mr. Verma had known... Yeah?
Do you not think that's a very narrow definition? Because it's not just about your external world, it's also about your internal world and your thoughts and feelings and desires and regrets.
That was just Google's definition. But I do think, going back to the point of living in an increased digitized nation, we are seeing the increase of people putting their feelings into things like diary app and things like messages. So again, that line between the privacy that you think you have and the privacy that the data companies then impeach on is very different. So yeah, whilst it's a narrow definition, I do think it can be expanded to what the privacy that companies like Facebook impeach on. But whether he should have sent that message or not is not the issue. It's the fact that a message he sent in private got picked up and caused him to be arrested. Claiming that privacy is not dead does not explain how this happened. The case of Mr. Verma isn't a one-off example either of privacy not being breached, but simply absent. Edward Snowden, found in 2013 in the National Security Agency in America, was bot collecting data from every single American. Emails, text messages, and search histories. This was far beyond the scope of what the public knew it included. It was collecting 5 billion records a day concerning the location of cell phones and mobile devices worldwide. The sheer fact that a governmental organization has the power to track your every digital movement isn't exactly something that fills you with faith in the level level of privacy that we have today. And it isn't all that far off to say that privacy is dead. It's not just government, it's also private companies like Cambridge Analytica, someone had to bring it up today, which developed an interface for Facebook where developers could see social connections between people and the connections they have based on their interests. This means I'm forever haunted by the McDonald's group chat that I was in. The Facebook developers probably think that my main interests include nugget wastage and, well, God knows what they think for my affiliations with the Litterific meme page. In conclusion, if you care about MILFs, vote with the proposition too. If you don't want the woke Avengers to read your messages, vote for the proposition. If you want to search for medieval term for DTF without your university seeing, vote for the proposition tonight. If not, this vote isn't private, and I will think of you all as a woke MILF hater.
That
I'm going up. What is that? What is that?
And I now welcome Luke Anthony Patrick McGuire to continue the case for the opposition.
I decided to come into this prepared as always, so what I have is 1 point from each of the people made. An artist's depiction of Satan eating one of his children. And phone with the lyrics of a very peculiar song. So here we go. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, and now apparently I'm a gender, which I did not see coming. First of all, you started with just too many numbers for my brain damaged mind to go through, so no. Then, I thought the first opposition spoke very, very well about the inner personal feelings and how they're completely private to one, to oneself. Someone else who also believed this was Isaiah Berlin in his famous work.
Okay, that's
too much. In his famous work about liberty. Because he talked about the Stoic inner citadel of the mind. No matter what authoritarian regime may do, they cannot get into your own inner mind.
On that point?
Yes.
Like, we do not argue that God has, you know, the ability to know one's inner thoughts and feelings at all times, and therefore you have no privacy in the eyes of God.
I love when he watches. That's better. But yes, on to the second prop. Just because it's an evil mega corporation doesn't mean they actually want to take advantage of you. Corporations have done such wonderful things for the world. I can only think of how they've brought the world forward through the advancement of technology, medicine, only through the, as some people say it, the evil jaws of capitalism. I don't. I think they're beautiful. Those bloody teeth. Oh. It is that that brings the human race forward. We should not be afraid of these people. They only want to help. They wouldn't take advantage of us by taking our privacy. Second up, you just said we can choose not to give them stuff. Yes. Third, MILFs and a change of norms is what I've written here. You okay? Change norms. Of course, norms change constantly. So they do, especially around things like privacy, and hopefully, I actually don't want to ask about the MILFs. So I don't. Whatever that is about. But to my larger point, I just wanted to let you all know how worthless most people's lives truly are. I want you to know that when you wake up every single day, that you go to school for however many years, and then you go to university for however many years, and then you finally clock into that job, and you go through the motions, you marry the wife or the husband or the Luke. It's not a gender. So then you have your 2.5 kids, and then roughly at the age of 54, you blow your brains out. Because.
On that point.
James!
Yeah, what do you mean by 2.5 kids? Is it top half or bottom half?
Middle. But yes, the 2.5 kids then suicide.
Jesus. Why and under God would any of these beautiful corporations have any interest in making money from you, such a mundane, boring bunch? You don't bring anything to society, and that is the rich. There is no motivation for these people to actually do it. The only reason we believe this, very sadly, is for delusions of grandeur, of which I do not have. There are people whose privacies they would look to infringe on. People like the Napoleons and the Muhammads of the world, as Dostoevsky is saying, Crime and Punishment. They are above other people. They are better than you. All right. Again, I would like to talk about the beautiful mega corporations. I would just like to bring us all to a mental image. We're standing there, we're looking at a Tesco's. Could be a Walmart in America, who knows? And you just see that the hideous halogen bulbs that make up that all-night beautiful corporation. The uneasy truce between all the others that exist there. And then the doors slide open, and a sweet old man greets us, and a blast of hot air hits us. And can't you see, friends, that everything there is glowing, resplendent with objects from China, Indonesia, Bangladesh, and beyond? So clean, so sweet, so friendly. I wish it were happening somewhere else, anywhere else. But here we are. We can get the same toothbrush in Dundalk as we can in Belfast, in Belfast as we can in London as we can in Bucharest. I might just fall to my knees at the amazing glory and abundance that is the sameness of all things in this, the last hours of this godforsaken Babylon. It's like the oceans are rising. It's like we're all waiting on New York City and LA to be swallowed up by the tides. It's like we're all having our own personal and private apocalypses, because society is so fractured these days that no one actually knows each other, that no one has any deep feelings towards each other. This is what it means by actual privacy. It's the fake facade that most people give up to each other. A picture, a face, a mask. But the truth is, no one actually shows who they truly are. More today, now than ever. Especially because of social media. Social media does not bring us together, it pushes us apart. It shows fake honesty and the most violent form of privacy. That which we think is comradeship. So, I would like to leave you all tonight knowing that I was sparring last night and I'm lightly concussed. I can't remember most of what I've said, but I stand by it. And to prove that this was a very private thing, I came to here with nothing written and did not know what to say. And I love you all.
Well, we started off the debate very sad indeed, as we heard of Oren's Valentine's Day and Talsha crying on shift at McDonald's. We then moved to sort of whatever was kind of at that side of the table. We moved on to Ella's speech. You know, as the Literific prides itself as a family-friendly society, I was could not be more supportive of her using specific acronyms to outline people, the acronym being, I think, and please correct me if I'm wrong, it's Man I Love Frogs. Now, if I could find a website to connect me with other frog lovers, my privacy can go straight out of the window. Hugh, I want you to know that I've seen your tie and I appreciate it. I know you want someone to comment it on it, so there we go. I've seen it and I have appreciated it. And then Luke, I was writing notes for everyone's speech and I sort of written what question mark. But then you did have maybe 20 seconds of where you made something that brought you back, so that was greatly appreciated. But I think especially yours, but maybe a couple of other speeches we've heard tonight, do not increase do not assist my drive into getting new members and increasing participation in the society. I think my reflection on the whole privacy debate would be that no one in this room, none of my friends back home, none of my flatmates, nobody I've ever come into contact with has ever found my Minecraft YouTube videos from when I was 10 years old. So I would say that my privacy has been protected, and that's my two cents on the debate. But let's move on now properly to questions for either side. So we'll start with any questions for the proposition. Tom.
I kind of want to know Brexit is dead. When did it like start? We sort of threw off like national stuff. It should have been months from decades and decades and decades ago. Then imagine what a you should be doing.
My Minecraft YouTube videos, thank you. I'm afraid that's not me. Proposition to respond.
Sure. Whenever you talk about privacy, there's so you can talk about actual physical privacy, you can talk about informational privacy. Obviously, we've seen a slow decline. I don't think there's any need to put a specific date on when it happens. But especially in a legal sense, if we're talking about the common law, it's dead because it's never been alive, especially in the history of the United Kingdom. But if we're talking about like informational privacy, the government historically could have just requested, you have no protection against if the state calls you for information, because obviously we have parliamentary supremacy here. But if we're talking about tech corporations and giants, obviously we've seen in the last like 30, 40 years just this steady decline of how well you control your own informational privacy. So it depends which definition of privacy we're going with. The first two, dead, never been alive. Informational privacy, you can argue a case that maybe before the Cold War it was a thing, but it's just been a steady decline.
Opposition to respond?
Okay, so obviously we do not think that privacy has ever died. It is still alive and well, because to die is to obliterate completely, never to come back. And as I said in my speech, we still have time to like it's eroded a little, but we still have time to like make laws that can solve that. Like to put it into like historical context, say if we were debating in 1824, we might be debating that childhood is dead because there were no laws to protect children. Then they made laws to protect children so that they didn't get like killed in mines and in factories. We still have time to unerode the bit of privacy that is gone. And also there is still a lot of privacy left. You cannot just have this narrow definition of it about the data that the tech companies have, because there's also internal privacy and your own thoughts and feelings as well.
Thank you. We'll go to a question for the opposition. Terry?
The opposition speech is, I can't really make out what Luke was all about. But the first thing, Talsha seemed to, her argument seemed to focus on that if you have your own thoughts, even though externally everything, like you're being spied on all the time, and you still have privacy. And then the second speaker, Hugh, sort of seemed to focus on internet privacy and kind of ignored my point of information where I was talking about if you walk out and you're in the general public, you're surveyed all the time. So I think the opposition's argument has basically been that we have privacy because you can just sit in the house with your own thoughts and you'll be, you know, you'll have privacy. That doesn't seem like much privacy to me if you actually want to go out and live.
Opposition?
Well, that wasn't the only thing I talked about in my speech. Obviously there is like internal privacy and having your own thoughts and feelings, and that can never really be taken away by like the internet or an algorithm. But I also displayed that the algorithm gets it wrong all the time, and then actually just having this data doesn't actually say anything about an individual. It puts you into a collective group. So like they know that on a street there are all these people and that they move, but it doesn't actually like say anything about that individual. That's why in like the California gang algorithm trying to find like California gang members, there were 42 babies under the age of one, because they thought, oh, these people have this name and they're in this location, so that, and they're this race, so that must mean that they're a gang member. It gets it wrong all the time. It puts you into a collective. It doesn't actually say anything about the individual or their privacy.
Proposition to respond?
Yeah, I think that's kind of what I was trying to get at with, sort of, the more we're becoming dependent on technology, the more sort of it becomes the privacy, your privacy, or the things you keep secret, you end up keeping on those devices, whether that's intentionally or unintentionally, through what you search, through what you type, through whatever big tech company is watching or they're not. I think, yeah, and the point about CCTV as well is it's kind of, okay, you can keep your thoughts private, but your thoughts and your actions say something, your actions say something about your thoughts rather, and that's what can be observed, so your thoughts can be inferred, so privacy is definitely not as alive as it used to be.
Thank you, and then do we have an abstention question that must be put fairly to both sides? Kira?
So here's the issue that I've heard with this concept of where's the line? Where is the line that says that if you cross this line, privacy is dead, it will never come back, etc. And where is the line where you consider that you have privacy in our modern world? Or where is the line where you say you don't, essentially? What's the line?
Go to the proposition first.
So I guess it's kind of, well, as I said, a bit limited, like, it's also subjective, like, you know, some people don't care about what they share, some care about other private information. And I think in terms of the line specifically from Brinkett, I kind of say that, like, it's to the degree that you have control over your information. And I think where it's definitely crossed is where you have things like what happened in 2013, where lots of emails, text messages, and phones were being recorded without people's knowledge. That's an invasion of privacy. That is where privacy is dead, so to speak. And it's the same with our over-reliance on things like social media. As much as you can argue, you can actually like that technology, it is an incredibly difficult life, and it's not one that's necessarily maintainable in the modern world, and that's why I say it's privacy. That's where the line is between privacy and what people dead.
Just the opposition.
You just say it's subjective and want to give an objective measure of it. I don't think that your entire side, even two of you together, have given any sort of consistent line of what is privacy. At least me and Tasha did make clear that we were talking about the inner emotions and thoughts of the given people at the time, and instead of having to clarify it in a question afterwards and not doing so, me and Tasha, I thought, done that rather well, as mental as what I say usually is.
Do we have another question for the proposition? Another one for the opposition? Or another abstention?
Yeah,
maybe. Go for it.
It doesn't matter. This whole debate seems to focus on like absolute privacy on both sides. It's like either like privacy is dead enough, nobody should ever see you, or privacy is not dead enough, it doesn't matter. So is there any point at which privacy is a good thing to lose some of it or something? I kind of think balance this a wee bit for me.
We'll go to the opposition first.
Yeah, I think that the reason that we consent a lot, did you say privacy can be, losing privacy is good for a reason?
Yeah, like this whole thing is sort of being like, complete privacy. Both of you can focus on that, whether it's dead or it's not, but sometimes a bit of privacy goes for reasons.
So I think the reason that we like click accept cookies and we give all of our data to like social media and all is because, first of all, we're incredibly social beings and we love the convenience of like social media and apps on our phones. So we actually don't mind this little invasion of our privacy. We give it willingly. We consent to this information. And also, there's also an argument to be made that because we've become more online and we can kind of graft a persona of ourselves online, which we like more than our like actual selves, that actually gives us more privacy because people are more likely to see your online self. So I'd say that giving that could be a good thing.
Proposition.
Sure. If we're talking about like a balance of, because obviously, I kind of forgot I was speaking tonight, so I haven't said that I feel comfortable assessing right where I think the line should be drawn. As again, it's hard to draw a line at a social norm, because you can't use a quantitative assessment for something that a society feels. But if we're talking about like, when is it acceptable to give up a little bit of privacy for something else, I think no better example exists than the constant conflict between Article 8 privacy versus Article 10 freedom of expression and freedom of the press. And I'm very pro freedom of expression and freedom of the press.
And that's why I would support the wording of like the Human Rights Act, which says that we should essentially urge judges to, whenever taking in like privacy claims, always account for freedom of expression first and foremost. The issue comes whenever the majority of the case law, like every textbook will have a section where it basically says the case law is like 90% always favoring your Article 10 rights. I feel like you can strike a good balance whenever it starts to become like, if you actually have a genuine appeal and like the media has photographed your child or something, whenever you can have like a 60-40 or 50-50 chance that the judges will actually consider the relevant laws and not just 90-10 immediately go with potential for the media and freedom of expression with that. I feel like you can use that almost as a good quantitative measure for how you can assess like should we have absolute privacy or when it's acceptable to case that up.
Thank you. We'll move on now to the vote on speaker ability. So remember, this is the side you're most convinced by, the side that you think voted the best, and it can differ to your original vote, obviously. If you'd like to vote based on the vote or speaker ability for the proposition, please raise your hand now. If you'd like to vote for the opposition, please raise your hand now. And if you'd like to abstain, please raise your hand now. Can we get the vote of speaker ability, please?
The question at hand, there were 17 MILF lovers. five children for Luke, and five people lost the will to live. By that, the proposition has it.
Before we all race off, we'll be heading down to Lavery's in the woodworkers bit this evening. We have Conversazioni coming up, so please make sure if you've not bought your ticket already to do so. And next week in the Great Hall, we have a debate in collaboration with the charity Friends of the British Overseas Territories for the debate for the motion, this house would retain the British Overseas Territories. There'll be tea and coffee served beforehand, and there will be wine served to both participants and attendees afterwards. If you'd like to come along, the doors for that are open about 6:45. It's in the Great Hall, and we expect to vacate the room for about 10:30. And it's part of the Imagine Festival, which we're lucky to partner with this year, who have a variety of other great events, some paid, some free, all across Belfast next week, that I would encourage you all to go over to their website and have a look. This is the 10th festival. It's bigger than ever, and we are proud to partnered with them this year, as we were last year, to deliver this event, which I look forward to seeing you all at. Thank you very much, and congratulations to the proposition.